Welcome to the David Yosefon Podcast. I'm David Yosefon, Peter Canisius S.J. Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law. This episode of the podcast will be part two of the audio version of my law review article, Moby Dick as Corporate Catastrophe. For part one of the audio version, please see the previous episode in this podcast series. Please know that you can find all of my writings and podcasts and other work through my website at davidyosefon.com. There you will also find contact information if you want to drop me a line. And now, with no further ado, part two and the conclusion of my article, Moby Dick as Corporate Catastrophe, Law, Ethics, and Redemption. A Redeeming Corporate Conception of the Human Condition. As the corporation began to take its modern institutional form and exert its great economic influence in the 19th century, the great literary minds of that era began to grasp its spiritual significance too. Or, following Oscar Wilde, who insisted, "The sentiments of an age reflect its artistic achievements," rather than the other way around. Let us say instead that the spiritual significance of the corporation was first authored by the great writers of that day. Just as the corporate organizational form was not discovered but made, so too is the meaning of the corporation a creative, created endeavor. One kind of familiar spiritual idea of the corporation sounds in warning tones. In his influential 1841 essay, Self-Reliance, the American transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson rued the turning over of personal independence to social institutions and tried to rally his readers against it. To draw out his thesis, Emerson took as metaphor for his foil not ancient, obvious curs of individualism like the state, religion, or the family, but invoked instead the deadening communalism of the corporation. Quote, "Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. Society is a joint stock company in which the members agree, for the better securing of his bread to each shareholder, to surrender the liberty and culture of the eater. The virtue in most request is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion." Close quote. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Self-Reliance. Emerson's theme is not that corporations are deadening to individuality, but rather that society is deadening to individuality. The corporation is invoked as a way of seeing this damnable truth. In the same way that Plato examined types of cities in the Republic as a way to more clearly appraise truths about the individual human soul. In Moby Dick, published 10 years after Emerson's essay, Melville also repeatedly invokes the conceit of the corporation to scaffold his conception of the human situation. However, Melville found in the corporation, or makes from the corporation, a notion of the individual's relationship to society that is more forgiving, more embracing than Emerson's declensionary trope. Melville is less interested in independence and more concerned with relatedness and mutuality, which he sees as a means through which we might transcend the belittlement of lonesomeness and place. When Queequeg first told Ishmael of his travels from his Pacific Island home to the West, he said his early enthusiasm for learning about the bigger world had led him only to the conclusion that, quote, it's a wicked world in all meridians, close quote. Just a few pages past this sad confession comes a scene that at first seems to buttress the assessment, but in the end repudiates it. Having met in New Bedford, Ishmael and Queequeg make their way by boat to Nantucket, where they will look to join a whaling voyage. In the course of that passage, they encounter a New England rube who racially harasses Queequeg. Unintimidated, Queequeg throws the man in the air, flipping him full over. This does the rube no physical damage, but draws for Queequeg a warning that he will be put off the boat if he does not desist. Soon after, a big wave hits the boat and knocks the rube overboard. Unable to spot the man, most on board quickly give him up for drowned. But Queequeg jumps into the sea, undertakes a prodigious swim, pulls the man up from under the water, and drags him safely back to the boat. In striving to explain the conduct he saw in Queequeg, Ishmael finds a morality rooted in a corporate conception. Quote, he seemed to be saying to himself, it's a mutual joint stock world in all meridians. We cannibals must help these Christians. Close quote. The idea of the corporation here shepherds the imagination, Queequeg's imagination, as imagined by Ishmael, as imagined by Melville, to a more cooperative, benevolent conception of human relationships, abandoning the, quote, wicked world in all meridians, close quote, idea that had been patronized without it just a few pages previously. The idea of the corporation facilitates a similar conception of human mutuality as against rank individuality later in the book. We find Ishmael on the Pequod, tethered to one end of a monkey rope, the other end of which is tied to Queequeg, who is overboard on the body of a dead whale, preparing it to be hoisted on deck. The work is dangerous for Queequeg and nearly equally so for Ishmael because of the rope connecting them. If the waves or the sharks feasting on the carcass drag Queequeg under, Ishmael will be pulled under too. Now, it may be otherwise for a monkey, but for a human, to be tied to a monkey rope is to think about what it means to be tied to a monkey rope. The corporate form aids Ishmael's thinking about it. To forge an understanding of his connection to Queequeg in this moment, Ishmael flies past friendship, marriage, or martial affection, finding the metaphor he seeks in the corporation instead. So strong, quote, so strongly and metaphysically did I conceive of my situation then, that while earnestly watching his motions, I seemed distinctly to perceive that my own individuality was now merged in a joint stock company of two, that my free will had received a mortal wound, and that another's mistake or misfortune might plunge innocent me into unmerited disaster and death. Ishmael is led by this corporate conception of his situation to a clearer perception of the human condition as a whole and an understanding of the interconnectedness of his own life. At first, he saw the artificial device tying him to his shipmate's fate as abhorrent to the proper state of man as self-reliant. Quote, here was a sort of interregnum in providence, for its even-handed equity never could have so gross an injustice, close quote. But thinking it through, he comes to understand the inevitability of human connection. Quote, I saw that this situation of mine was the precise situation of every mortal that breathes. Only in most cases, he, one way or the other, has this conjoined connection with a plurality of other mortals. If your banker breaks, you snap. If your apothecary by mistake sends you poison in your pills, you die. Handle Queequeg's monkey rope heedfully as I would. Sometimes he jerked it so that I would come very near sliding overboard. Nor could I possibly forget, do what I would, I had only the management of one end of it. Close quote. Ishmael's recognition that he is inevitably involved with other people is catalyzed by his first conceiving of his situation as being like a joint stock company. He builds from that idea to a mature, accepting understanding of the relatedness of all humankind. A superficially more apt business vehicle through which Melville might have exemplified a fated union of two people would surely have been a partnership, especially in 1851, when partnerships were still the most widespread business organization. But the more cutting-edge corporation is the better device for slicing through solipsism into the understanding of inescapable entanglement at which Ishmael arrives. Partnerships are at-will arrangements. They can be dissolved whenever a partner wants to quit and walk away, cutting their losses. But Ishmael is at no such liberty here. In contrast to partnerships, a core feature of the corporation is that once capital has been invested, it is locked in, and investors cannot demand a corporate dissolution to liquidate their own stake. Hard as the rule of capital lock-in seems, it is not in the end lamented by investors. It is foundational to the efficacy they seek in joining up with corporate enterprise. Lock-in is the feature of corporate law that enables commitment of large amounts of capital to complex long-term projects like building a railroad, putting together a whaling expedition, or creating a social media platform. Neither does Ishmael rue the depth of his interpersonal commitments, nor should we rue our own inescapable commitments, for these bring life meaning that far surpasses what could be produced in self-reliance. At the start of the book, Ishmael was depressed, dour, even suicidal. But after he meets and becomes involved with Queequeg and the Pequod, though he has more at risk and bears great risk over which he has little control, management, he is happier and more complete than ever he was in self-reliance. The abstract nature of the corporation gives Melville the right vehicle to build up his metaphor for this other abstraction, the idea of human relatedness. These abstractions have consequences for our lives that are as real as any brute facts. For nothing is so real as U.S. Steel, Amazon, or human connection. In literal fact, as opposed to literary idea, Ishmael is free to walk away from the Pequod. Capital is locked in, but labor can exit. And this, as reviewed above, is one of the law's justification for shareholder primacy in corporate governance. Melville was well aware that sailors could abandon a whaling voyage, as he had done so twice himself. But Ishmael is not concerned here, and I am not concerned here, with locating his technical rights and responsibilities within the legal nexus of the firm. Instead, he and I are concerned with what sentiment of being the idea of the corporation might provide to him to help him make a gratifying sense of himself and his relationship to others. Melville sees in the corporate form a promising way to think about life. What is at issue, and what I want to build on here, is not so much the material effects of the corporate organization of production, but the efficacy of the corporate idea as a means of organizing our self-conception. I'm not arguing that inner peace and personal power are to be found in accepting and internalizing one's role in the capitalist design. Moby Dick is not a book about a whale. Instead, I am urging us to see within the corporate conception a workable approach to self-authorship, personal ethics, and a meaningful life. We are inevitably connected to one another. The corporate idea helps Ishmael to see this. Yet the corporate idea is rooted, too, in the idea of willful connection, a core principle of modern corporate law, and the agency law upon which it is built is voluntarism. This was not always so. Law is older than liberty, and agency law doctrines once found their justification in the status of persons designated into agency relationships. Some of the deep roots of agency law, for example, run through the poisonous ground of slavery, ancient, feudal, and American. The slave is subject to the commands of the master because of their socially assigned status. The master exercises control over the slave and answers for the slave's contracts and torts because their relative status dictates this result. The modern precepts of agency law repudiate this legacy by making voluntarism not only important, but utterly foundational, conceptually and doctrinally. Quote, agency arises when one person, a principal, manifests assent to another person, an agent, that the agent shall act on the principal's behalf and subject to the principal's control, and the agent manifests assent or otherwise consents so to act. Close quote. Restatement third of agency. Where agency relationships resulted from status, the meaning of those relationships was weighty and weighed down hard on the people who were cast in them. To be a master or to be a slave was to be subject to the law's power to dictate who you were and how you related to others. Agency law was then an agent of Roman privilege or white supremacy. Where, however, the agency relationship is formed through assent, the core meaning of the legal relationship abides in the intentionality of the association. Indeed, at the deepest level, voluntarism is not really the justification for the system. It is the purpose of the system. Corporations are desirable social institutions chiefly because they are occasions for intentionality. This, more than whale oil or widgets, is the most important thing that the corporate form produces. Moby Dick takes the principle of voluntarism seriously. Queequeg, the Pequod's master harpooner and friend to Ishmael, was born into a status-based society. His father and grandfather before him were kings of their island nation in the South Pacific, and Queequeg was also predestined to be king. But prescription is an unacceptable social description. Born a subject or born a king, a person born for being rather than becoming is closer to death than they are to living. Queequeg renounces his hereditary throne in order to redeem the only crown worth wearing, volunteer. He leaves the status realm, canoes out to a whaling boat that is sailing by, and signs on. Queequeg gives up his island paradise with its cannibalistic delights for the cramped grind of the whaling ship, because it is better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. Footnote. This is to say something specific about the human spirit, but it is not to say anything in particular about 19th century Pacific Island culture, about which Melville was surely mostly ignorant. C.F. Melville's first book, Typee, A Peep at Polynesian Life, 1846, was based on his experiences on the Marquesas Island after deserting a whaling voyage in 1842. Back to the text. Ishmael is also a volunteer. When we meet him in the book's opening passage, he tells us that a gloom had unaccountably come over him. There is passivity in his self-description. His mouth was growing grim, and he found himself, quote, involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, close quote. He is depressed, we would say, or unwell. His hypos were beginning to, quote, get an upper hand of him. Ishmael knows that the only way for him to counteract this melancholic, existential angst of being human is with the antidote of becoming human, volunteering, acting, taking command of his situation. For Ishmael, this means going to the sea. Not so much to the sea, in fact, as to the ship. Ishmael escapes his dour, drifting life by volunteering into relationships with Queequeg and with the nexus of relationships that is the Pequod. Now, we must not, in a romance of voluntarism, lose our heads to the abusive, exploitative labor conditions in the 19th century whale fishery, the 21st century gig economy, or anywhere else. The indecency in capitalism has too often been exonerated by the ideological seduction of choice fetishism. But neither can we allow the sordidness of such mesmerism to make us cynical to truths we want to revere. The reason we are on guard against the toxic use of voluntarism is because we venerate the idea in its unadulterated aspect, which is real. We should take from corporate law's focus on voluntarism a reflection and reminder of how important it really is to us, rather than allowing its fake use by ideologists to subvert our sense of its importance. Both Queequeg and Ishmael are serious about what voluntarism means to a meaningful life. They are not cowed by industrial conditions into giving up that truth, and we should not be either. Ishmael knows he is coming in for some fairly intense bossing around in signing up with a whaling firm. He explains that, deeply speaking, there's no way around this. Quote, who ain't a slave? Tell me that. Well then, however the old sea captains may order me about, however they may thump and punch me about, I have the satisfaction of knowing that it is all right, that everyone else is, one way or another, served in much the same way, either in a physical or metaphysical point of view. That is, and so, the universal thump is passed around, and all hands should rub each other's shoulder blades and be content. Close quote. More than personal explanation, this is existential instruction. The truth about ourselves, the meaning of our voluntarism must be found within the contradiction, the seeming contradiction between having to serve and being free. Since you are sure to serve in some way, do not shy from the liberating, self-making gusto that comes in volunteering to it. The rule of law, the free society, the just society, neither alleviates us from the burden nor robs us of the opportunity of serving somebody. To be free is not to choose whether or not to serve. As to that, you have no choice. To be free is to choose how you will serve and what it will mean to you. As the philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre diagnosed it, more or worse than being free to choose, we are compelled to it. Quote, "I am condemned to be free," Sartre wrote. To be human is to confront contingency. There is no exit to necessity. The roughest cannibal must know that he could be a vegetarian. He has no choice but to choose cannibalism or not. Ahab could quit chasing the white whale and be loyal to the stockholders instead. The lying lawyer can stop or keep doing it. The conscript is not a stone or a horse. They could rebel or try to escape or acquiesce, but they cannot do nothing because they are inescapably free to do as they will. The body cannot always be moved as we desire, but we cannot escape the freedom to determine our attitude toward the situation of our existence and how we will behave within the domain of freedom that confronts us. We want to stomp out slavery, rescue the poor, and end invidious discrimination, not to make people free, but because human beings are free. And it is an abomination to institutionalize any other version of the truth. We do not create the principle of freedom. We realize it. We redeem it. And we ramify it. Seeing this conceptually in law and art can improve your vision and acuity for freedom in every aspect of your life. The corporate conception of volunteerism draws our attention to this truth and makes it unavoidable. But is this how it is or only how it seems? In The Inhalation, Moby Dick centers and celebrates the reality of human willfulness. In The Exhalation, it is alert to the worrisome reverse. Situational pressures in our social environment combine with unseen features of our psychology to compel our thinking and behavior in ways we only mistakenly perceive as freely chosen. We seem to act, but may be merely acting. This is the Janus truth of the human condition. Corporate theory invites us to elevate our conception of voluntarism and its meaning in our life. But the very emphasis that it puts on the idea leads us to complicate our understanding of it and leaves us rightly questioning the design of the corporation that inspired the line of thought. I want to pursue this problem by excavating a crucial ambiguity in a core corporate word, agency. It is strange that sometimes words mean both what they mean and also the opposite of what they mean. Sanction means to allow, yet sanction means to punish for having done something forbidden. Stay somehow means both to continue and to stop. Bolt means to secure something from coming loose. It also means to flee fast from something. Linguists call these contronyms or Janus words. The phenomena remains shrouded in mystery, but certainly seems, or sometimes can be made to seem, to hint at something profound. The word agency is a contronym. We might see in its two faces not random variation, but some kind of sublime incantation. We say something has agency when we mean it acts intentionally, with its own ends in mind. Yet an agent is someone who works on behalf of and subject to the control of another person. Again and again, in everyday usage, we trip over these contradictory senses of the word. This linguistic knot is expressive of a core ambivalence we have about ourselves. Footnote. In a brief essay from 1910, Sigmund Freud discussed with enthusiasm the then recent discovery of contronyms in ancient Egyptian. See Sigmund Freud, The Antithetical Meaning of Primal Words, 1910. Freud noted the parallels between contronyms and representations in dreams, which often seem both to mean one thing and also the very opposite. Finding contronyms in the earliest recorded human language suggested to Freud that they were related to the emergence of concepts in human thinking itself. He speculated that better understanding the mysteries of contronyms might aid in figuring out how dreams work. To pursue this further here, quote, would be to dive deeper than Ishmael can go, close quote. But I will note that Ahab, confused as to the meaning of his agency, has bad dreams. See Moby Dick, quote, exhausting and intolerably vivid dreams, close quote. Back to the text. The ideas and language of agency law give figure to this ambivalence within the text of Moby Dick. A topsy-turvy confusion about who is an agent in command and who is a commanded agent recurs throughout the novel. Nowhere is the ambiguity more precisely expressed than with respect to the whale itself. When first revealing his intention to hunt Moby Dick, Ahab says he does not know whether the white whale is itself the malevolent force that goads him, or whether the whale is merely serving that force. Ahab cuts through this uncertainty by making it irrelevant. Quote, I see in him outrageous strength with an inscrutable malice sinewing in it. That inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate, and be the white whale agent, or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Footnote. This is doctrinally sound, for one operating on behalf of a hidden principle is liable themselves for business they undertake with third persons, be they in fact only an agent of the principle. Restatement third of agency. Back to the text. While unsure about the status of Moby Dick, Ahab himself at first expresses no doubt in the principle of his own agency. Starbuck, the first mate, warns Ahab off his quest, saying it is blasphemy to seek vengeance on an animal that acted out of instinct, that is, blasphemy to endow agency to a mere agent of impulse. But Ahab is no agent of piety, nor servant even to any general notion of fair play. His agency is unbound. So he says, quote, talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. For could the sun do that, then could I do the other, since there is ever a sort of fair play herein. But not my master is even that fair play. Who's over me? Truth hath no confines. Close quote. But since unconfined truth encompasses ambiguity, Ahab's doubt about whether the white whale is principal or agent soon swims round to stove his own self-conception. As we have seen it is corporate law which serves in the novel to introduce this doubt. After Starbucks' "Let Ahab beware Ahab" warning, Ahab becomes aware that something other than his own principal purpose may be driving his pursuit of the whale. Thereafter, Ahab is haunted not just by Moby Dick, but by doubts about the basis of his own behavior. Sometimes Ahab thinks he is an agent. Other times he suspects that he is merely an agent to some other source of command. The captain of the Samuel Enderby, who has lost an arm to Moby Dick, gives Ahab prudent advice as to their mutual nemesis. Quote, "He's best left alone," close quote. Ahab sees the wisdom in this, but sees too that he is powerless to follow it. "He is," Ahab says, "but he will still be hunted for all that. What is best let alone, that accursed thing is not always what least allures. He's all a magnet," close quote. And then, before the final scenes, before the actual confrontation with Moby Dick, we find the Pequod's captain alone, looking out on the cold sea, desperately asking, quote, "Is Ahab Ahab?" close quote. As human psychology will have it, the greater the suggestion that the white whale is pulling him, the more radically does Ahab assert that it is he who is chasing the whale. To satisfy his motive to self-affirm, to view himself as in control, Ahab tries to overwhelm the constant hints of compulsion with the sound and fury of self-assertion. Shouting into a typhoon, he proclaims his willfulness against the unseen force he identifies as tormenting him. Even as the awful, inscrutable, devouring universe seems intent on controlling Ahab, Ahab refuses the call to agency, insisting instead that he is an agent. No fearless fool now fronts thee. I own, that is, I acknowledge, thy speechless, placeless power. But to the last gasp of my earthquake life will dispute its unconditional, unintegral mastery in me, in the midst of the personified, impersonal, a personality stands here, though but a point at best. Whensoever I came, wheresoever I go, yet while I earthly live, the queenly personality lives in me and feels her royal rights. Thou canst blind, but I can then grope. Thou canst consume, but I can then be ashes. Close quote. Ahab taunts the divine with this insistence upon his own autonomy. But even in this moment, Ahab cannot escape the contronymic mystery of agency. And he projects those confusion bolts even at God, saying that he senses, and God must sense too, that there is some force controlling God, that God too is an agent and not agent. Quote, "Thou knowest not how came ye? Hence callest thyself unbegotten. There is some unsuffusing thing beyond thee, thou clear spirit, to whom all thy eternity is but time, all thy creativeness mechanical. O thou foundling fire, thou hermit immemorial, thou too hast thy incommunicable riddle." Close quote. By privileging volunteerism, corporate law compels us to interrogate what volunteerism really means. In so doing, we are reminded of why we revere the idea and are reminded of why we are doubtful about it. But corporate law is finally no philosophical inquiry. And like Ishmael going to the sea, we are intent on living our lives, not just thinking them through. Even as it sustains our attention to the deep mysteries, the discourse of corporate law also provides practical wisdom for the pursuit of meaning, excellence, and vitality, which must be undertaken in the midst of doubt. The corporate association is formed in this self-authoring brio of volunteerism. Then, within the corporate association, the law prescribes to its agents the imperative to go, to serve the purpose of your association with verve. The statute says, quote, "The business and affairs of every corporation shall be managed by the board of directors." Corporate agents cannot be passive. They must act. This is an idea about life that is rescuing. It is an imperative to salutary willfulness that cures, quote, "the pain of idleness," close quote. Bob Dylan, Every Grain of Sand, 1981. This corporate instruction to act is bound by an obligation not to act selfishly, but rather to act selflessly. Act with imaginative loyalty to the life project with which you are engaged. This is an escape from degenerative solipsism into creative involvement with the world. Thus do our obligations become opportunities to transcend our own limitations and become excellent in our lives beyond those responsibilities. I am not suggesting dedicating your life to the pursuit of some corporation's bottom line. Not any more than Melville is telling a story about a whale hunt. I am urging us to see within the corporate idea, with Melville's aid, the working out of a framework for personal ethics that can produce meaning worth having. Counseling the corporate conscience, Starbucks failure. Where were the lawyers? The question is repeated as often as there are new rounds of corporate disasters that could have been averted if corporate lawyers had been on the forward deck doing their duty. I want to turn now to the role of the lawyer in averting or facilitating corporate catastrophe by assessing the failure of Mr. Starbuck, the first mate, who I will reasonably call the general counsel of the Pequod. Footnote. They may try to take away my literary license for this pro hoc vice construction of Starbuck, but I will risk it. In defense, I will cite to at least some dicta in John Huston's estimable film adaptation of Moby Dick, MGM 1956, which has Starbuck pulling a law book off a cabin shelf and reading it to his fellow officers about their rights and duties in the face of Ahab's misconduct, a scene which does not appear in the book. To draw out the lessons for corporate lawyering that can be seen in Moby Dick, I deliberately decline to assess Starbuck's behavior in terms of 19th century admiralty law. In general, it seems that admiralty law requires tremendous deference on the part of all shipboard subordinates to the commands of the captain, except where those orders are clearly unlawful or unreasonable. Back to the text. Corporate lawyers must comport themselves to the idea that they serve the corporate entity and not the natural persons who are in charge of it, running it. This is hard. It is hard for the same reason that it is easy for a corporate officer to think of the business as their own. The corporation is abstract, but everyone can see and hear the CEO, and everyone does what the CEO says. It requires an active ethical imagination to keep the lawyer thinking straight about their duties to the firm and acting accordingly. The rules of professional conduct make clear that if a lawyer knows that an officer within their firm is behaving in a way that threatens to harm the firm, the lawyer must act to protect the corporation. See Model Rule of Professional Conduct 1.13. Starbuck is a stiff. a by-the-book man, but not much of a reader of them. Quote, Starbuck was no crusader after perils. In him, courage was not a sentiment, but a thing simply useful to him, close quote. Moby Dick. This is good enough in the ordinary course, but it is inadequate to the extraordinary. We create corporations because we want extraordinary coordination, extraordinary production, and extraordinary consumption. We want corporate power and the accomplished use of that power. To have this power, we must, as part of the corporate project, expand to the ethical capacities of lawyers beyond the ordinary. A dinghy crew might get by with a man of ordinary courage as general counsel, but a large corporation, capable of fantastic wrongdoing, must have a lawyer of fantastic ethical impulse to guide it, or if need be, to grind up its gears. At the, quote, all-hands meeting, where Ahab makes plain his intention to hunt Moby Dick instead of pursuing the ship's stated business purpose, only Starbuck offers any resistance to the plan. In fact, Starbuck raises a momentary doubt as to whether it even was that particular whale that took up Ahab's leg in the first place. Quote, Captain Ahab, I have heard of Moby Dick, but it was not Moby Dick that took off thy leg. The captain snaps back. Quote, who told thee that? Cried Ahab, then pausing. Aye, Starbuck, aye, my hearties all around. It was Moby Dick that dismasted me. After that, the rest of the firm accepts the captain's definition of the situation. Starbuck tries to dissuade Ahab, first with appeal to self-interest. Quote, how many barrels will thy vengeance yield thee, even if thou gettest it, Captain Ahab? It will not fetch thee much in our Nantucket market. But Ahab has already done the cost-benefit analysis, and he prefers blood to oil. Quote, my vengeance will fetch a great premium here, he says as he smites his chest. Starbuck also appeals to morality and to religion to try to get Ahab to stop. Quote, vengeance on a dumb brute. To be enraged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous. Ahab, like many moderns, is not God-fearing. Quote, talk not to me of blasphemy, man. As we have seen, the only thing that moves Ahab for a moment is when Starbuck appeals to fiduciary scriptures, not just the black letter of it, but deeply, first reminding Ahab that he is being disloyal to the ship's owners, and then excavating an idea that in hunting Moby Dick, the vengeful Ahab is being disloyal to himself. That worked. But Starbuck does not sustain that approach. Had he done more, he might have gotten through to Old Thunder. Had Starbuck focused his own self-conception deeply in terms of his fiduciary obligations, he might have been better nourished to the task that befell him and might have saved the crew, the ship, and himself. But Starbuck's idea of duty is too thin, and he does not go down deep enough or long enough to get what is really needed. Ahab pulls out every trick in the corrupt CEO's handbook to bend his general counsel to his will. He ridicules, quote, take off thine eye. More intolerable than fiends' glarings is a doltish stare. And he flatters, quote, the best lance of out of all Nantucket, surely he will not hang back. He uses social proof to pull Starbuck to his purpose, pointing out that the other ship's officers are with him. Quote, see Stubb, he laughs. See yonder Chilean, he snorts to think about it. Stand up amid the general hurricane, thy one tossed sapling cannot, Starbuck. Ahab primes the dissonance avoidance mechanism standing at the ready in Starbuck's mind. He urges the first mate to see the hunt for the white whale as actually in keeping with the ordinary business of the ship. Quote, "'Tis but to help strike a fin, no wondrous feat for Starbuck. What is it more?" As Ahab pressures him, Starbuck falls into silence. No good habit for corporate counsel facing executive misconduct. Ahab then goads him. Quote, "It is thy silence, then, that voices thee. Starbuck now is mine." It takes a special hubris for an executive to scheme as wildly as Ahab, but just common human frailty for a corporate lawyer like Starbuck to let him get away with it. Subordinate to a charismatic leader who has the frothy allegiance of the crew, Starbuck is motivated to find reasons not to act against the tide sweeping over the ship. Being creative and intelligent, he is able to find those reasons. He sees that something is seriously wrong, but decides that there is still plenty of time before he needs to act, if indeed he needs to act at all. Maybe the problem will work itself out. The harm may potentially be great, but maybe it is not very likely to occur after all. They are perhaps not even likely to find Moby Dick out there in the vast ocean. Quote, "Yet is there hope. Time and tide flow wide. The hated whale has the round watery world to swim in, as the small goldfish has its glassy globe." The bullish optimism bias steers Starbuck to figure that things will probably work out all right, as things tend to. Quote, "His heaven-insulting purpose God may wedge aside." Close quote. Too many fiduciaries, too many general counsels lose the opportunity to stop festering misconduct by a corporate leader before it metastasizes throughout the firm they are charged to protect, hoping instead that the problem will go away. Starbuck does not admit to himself what any serious ethical person must know. A person who goes looking for Moby Dick will find him. The first time the men of the Pequod lower for a whale hunt, long before they find Moby Dick, they discover an extra crew that Ahab had stowed away to aid his secret mission. If one squints, the scene can look enough like normal business to be treated like it. Ahab himself, in lowering with the crew, we are told, looks the same as he had in 1,000 lowerings before. The stowaway crew is, after all, pulling alongside him and the others in the hunt. In his dissonance avoidance, Starbuck goes so far as to conclude that Ahab's opportunism might in the end be profitable. Stubb, a junior officer, asks Starbuck what he thinks of the stowaways. Starbuck jibber-jabbers, quote, "Sad business, Mr. Stubb. But never mind, Mr. Stubb. All the best. There's hogsheads of sperm ahead, Mr. Stubb, and that's what we came for. Pull, pull, my boy. Sperm, sperm's the play. This, at least, is duty. Duty and profit, hand in hand." And just like that, all can seem right enough to Starbuck. He tries to focus on his work as a way of dealing with the looming institutional disaster, as if he might get away with being blameless when what is called for is to be brave. Starbuck is overwhelmed by the cult of personality threatening the firm to the point where he overestimates the power of the CEO standing in the way of his duty. Starbuck claims that he does not know what to do about Ahab, that he is confused, but there's no cause for confusion. Quote, "Is there no other way, no lawful way? Make him a prisoner to be taken home? What? Hope to wrest this old man's living power from his own living hands? Only a fool would try it. Say he were pinioned, even, knotted all over with ropes and hawsers, chained down to ring bolts on this cabin floor. He would be more hideous than a caged tiger. I could not endure the sight. Could not possibly fly his howlings. All comfort, sleep itself, inestimable reason would leave me on the long, intolerable voyage. Close quote. This is the sum of corporate counsel's cowardice. It would make him uncomfortable. It is not that he worries that he is unauthorized to act, and what to do about the misconduct is not so hard to figure out. He could try to rally the men, or just a few of them, to join him. Ahab has a salty strength, no doubt, but he's past 50 years old, and he has only one leg. Or Starbuck could take a whaleboat and set sail for help from other whalers. It is not hard to imagine what he could do, but he cannot, does not bring himself to do it. Starbuck could have prevented the sinking of the Pequod. He knows right from wrong, and he wants to stop the evil he identifies, but he does not. What is missing is the oomph to carry him from what he knows he must do to actually doing it. A core text in the study of situational influence in human thinking and behavior is Stanley Milgram's seminal experiments on obedience to authority. You know about those experiments like you know about Moby Dick, whether you have read them or not. Milgram brought people into his lab and demonstrated that they would obediently administer electric shocks to a student in a learning experiment when directed to do so by a person in authority. And they would escalate the shocks, even with the student crying out in pain and asking for it to stop. The student was a collaborator and was not actually shocked, but the teacher thought it was real. A most crucial finding of Milgram's was that, for the most part, those subjects knew they were acting wrongly. They knew they should not be doing what they were doing, but they did it anyway. Milgram said it clearly, quote, "These subjects were not blindly obeying the experimenter's commands. They were seriously conflicted, but unable to transform an intellectual, moral conviction into action." It is not that Starbuck's motivated reasoning runs so deep that it changes his assessment of what he should do. Rather, it puts just enough doubt into the picture to keep him from doing what he otherwise knows he must do. Earlier, we saw that Ahab's last sorrow is that he has denied the captain's fond pride of going down with the ship. He watches it from a whaleboat. Starbuck's last ignominy is that he is at the helm when Moby Dick finally smashes and sinks the Pequod. When a corrupted CEO's nefarious doings are finally fully revealed and the festering harm to the firm can no longer be denied, it may often be the salted general counsel who is given hasty field promotion to steward over the firm's final undoing. But there is no fond pride in going down this way for Starbuck, for he too is the reason that the ship is sunk. He did not protect it from Moby Dick because he did not protect it from Ahab. Chisel Starbuck's name with the rest on the marbled memorial in the lost seaman's chapel, but scrub his name from the rolls of the Massachusetts bar. Conclusion. Big winds toss both to and fro. Melville is unembarrassed to present the corporation in contradictory aspect, and we should take instruction from that. Dogmatic celebrations or condemnations are for paperback writers. Moby Dick understands corporate corruption, alienation, and exploitation, and it sees depth, relatedness, and promise of transcendence in the corporate idea. This is a truthful, full telling that can guide assessment both of prevailing institutional arrangements and perennial existential problems. We can enchant our conception of the corporation and find in it an invitation to a deeper understanding of ourselves and a better living of our lives. I have been concerned here with finding meaning not in our lived experience of corporate conduct, but in our imagination of what the corporation is and what about life it describes. Art and literature can inspire this imagination. A book like Moby Dick can be as important to our conception of the corporation as is the Delaware Corporate Code, Chancery's Next Opinion, the Quarterly Statements of Amazon, or Google's next Super Bowl commercial. It can help us to understand how corporate law works and make for us what corporate law means. In a remarkable, challenging passage, Ishmael reflects on Starbucks' shortcomings, but insists that he would not have written the book if its only utility was to expose human frailty. Quote, "Men may seem detestable as joint stock companies and nations, knaves, fools, and murderers they may be. Men may have mean and meager faces, but man, in the ideal, is so noble and so sparkling, such a grand and glowing creature, that over any ignominious blemish in him, all his fellows should run to throw their costliest robes. We know about the lout in us. We recognize too well Ahab's selfish madness and Starbucks' cowardice. But we know deep inside, too, that this is not the last word about us, and not the best word. Yet where are we to find the material with which to stitch together a robe to throw over ourselves that could bring out our proper sparkle? I think we may find some useful cloth in that same corporate shroud in which we see the image of our self-condemnation. Had Starbuck or Ahab found the redemptive instruction available in fiduciary scriptures, either of them could have saved that ship, the men aboard, and themselves. The corporate ideas of mutuality, care, deference, loyalty, and good faith might help us to make the robe we need to cover up our meagerness and become more than what we were. Attired in such purple, we might then turn our attention back to the corporate form itself and make it function better, too. The end. Thank you for listening to this audio version of Moby Dick as Corporate Catastrophe, Law, Ethics, and Redemption. This article was first published in Volume 90 of the University of Cincinnati Law Review. The citation is 90, University of Cincinnati Law Review 372. You can find the full link on my website at davidyosefon.com. It's been a pleasure reading this article to you. I hope you have enjoyed it. I look forward providing audio versions of other scholarship, as well as undertaking other subjects in future podcast episodes. Thank you.